listening to Retronauts, and that's great. But how would you like to watch Retronauts too? Well, good news. This coming weekend, Bob and I will be presenting our second live panel of the year at Long Island Retro Gaming Expo, the Cradle of Aviation Museum in Garden City, New York. We'll be joined by Hardcore Gaming 101's Kurt Collada and Game Club 1990X's Xerxes, as we do our best to explain the history of Falcom's Dragon Slayer series, a long-running RPG franchise that's every bit as confusing as our Wonder Boy or Bubble Bobble episodes. So come see us live Thursday, August 13th at 12:30 p.m. You won't regret it, probably. This week in Retronauts, we're double jumping our way into your heart. Hi, everyone, and welcome.
Intros okay are there? Very good.
Hi, everyone. We've had something to drink now. This is Jeremy Parrish speaking for Retronauts East, and yes, it's time for another recording. Boy, that really threw me off, man. I gotta stop paying attention to you guys.
Is it like, did it throw you off that I laughed at your funny joke?
Yeah, no one ever laughs at the things I say. They're like, God, another dad joke. Shut up.
Well, I like it.
Okay, well, I'm there dad. We go. Right, so you're just like, oh yeah, you don't
that's
even
just normal
you don't even
me.
Hear it as a joke. Yeah. You're just like, oh, he's just communicating he's being, like a normal human.
Yeah. Hi, he's dad. Being serious. I'm Chris.
Hey, wow. Do you guys want to okay, become dads so now, too? It's awesome.
Yeah, that'd be
anyone
great,
can do it.
Not anyone. There's
most
there are,
people.
There are some moving parts involved.
There,
you need like you need co-participation for that sort of thing.
That's weird. I thought it just sort of happened. The kids show up at your house.
Oh yeah,
Parthenogenesis. The second one because we got so off track in the first one.
I think so. We're starting where we left off with the last episode, which is nonsense or retro nonsense, yeah. as apparently that's the name of the show now.
Thanks to the power and convenience of the MP3 format, you can listen to Retronauts on any device you want, even in N-Gage for crying out loud. But for the best Retronauts listening experience, please consider the new Podcast One app. With the Podcast One app, you can find out everything about your favorite show and get more content from Retronauts. The app also makes it easy to comment and connect with other Retronauts fans. And with the Podcast One app, you can get 360-degree video or watch a bunch of shows in virtual reality, including Retronauts. That's right, now you can be right here in a tiny stuffy vault with four other people, but without the musky odors. And it should be mentioned, the Podcast One app looks so cool and gives you so many things to do, like winning rewards just for listening. That's right, everything Milhouse wanted from the Itchy and Scratchy show in 1997 is finally happening in 2017, and the future is magical! Download the Podcast One app today in the App Store or on Google Play.
Metroidvania games are all about figuring out the proper path through a complex maze-like world. That's fun in video games, but less so when it comes to mapping out your career through the confusing labyrinth of the jobs market. If you're wondering where to find the career equivalent of double jump boots so you can leap to the next section of your career, you should consult DICE. DICE can provide insight and guidance about new directions based on your skills, experience, and location. They'll even show you which skills you need to make the move, as well as which career paths are in demand right now. DICE has been connecting tech pros with job opportunities for more than 2 decades, and their full-scale career hub can connect you with the tools and resources you need to manage your career. Whether that means finding your next job, guiding your next career move, or simply backing you up when you ask your boss for a raise. DICE has insight into more than 70,000 tech jobs, including software development, UX, and project management. Learn more at dice.com/canyouhackit and hack your career with DICE. deep breath. Hi, everyone. This is Jeremy Parrish. It's Retronauts, Retronauts East, and we're here with a very exciting episode for you. We're going to talk about Metroidvania. But wait, Jeremy, you say, you already talked about Metroidvania, and that's true, we did. But we only talked about, like, half of the stuff that I had prepared notes for Metroidvania. So we're going to hit the back half of the notes this episode. Or we're going to work through, like, a third of the back half of the notes with the way this conversation's going already. But what will be, and we will talk about nonlinear platform action RPGs, by God, or it will be the death of us. Hmm. So, as you know, I am Jeremy Parrish, because this is the third time I've said that. But also, we have...
Benj Edwards.
And...
Chris Sims, here to talk about my favorite Metroidvania, Super Mario World.
No!
Damn it! We've already had this eschatological debate. Get out of here. Yes, so... In a previous episode, a couple of months ago, we talked about Metroidvania games. Really, it was more about sort of like the origin of the action RPG and how the platformer and the action RPG sort of came together as both of those genres were sort of even taking root. You know, you started having Metroidvania games just a couple of years after Super Mario Brothers came along and said, hey guys, this is how you do platforming. And so to me, like... The evolution of Metroidvania games through like 1994, 95 or so, when, you know, Super Metroid came out, is kind of like a parallel microcosmic version of the evolution of video games. Maybe I'm overstating that, but yeah, I really like these games.
Definitely.
And okay, Ben just got my back, so it's all good. So we're going to talk about the actual games that sort of laid down what the Metroidvania is, as opposed to sort of setting the stage for it, which we talked about last time. So really a lot of games developed between 1987 and 1994 or so, or however far we get with this conversation. So without further ado, let's mosey on in. So what is that theme you're humming?
Jeremy's theme.
Oh yeah, it's like Valerie's theme, but more Jeremy-ish. See, I feel like my theme would actually be like an 18-minute long progressive rock epic.
Yeah, I heard Jeremy's getting really into prog these days.
Yep.
These days.
I can't do drum solos and stuff, so I can't make that theme for you, sir.
That's okay. What was that song supposed to be? Was it a real one or did you just make it up?
I'm just making stuff up. I mean, I like to make fun of this show.
You need to go home and like
I honestly thought you were doing the first little bit of Vampire Killer.
What? That one or the?
That's the one.
I did that last episode.
Did you?
Not do the thing. Yeah, I'm going to have to write a theme now for Jeremy.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, we're probably going to cut this part. But yeah. Anyway, so. So. Where was I? Right. Cut. We were talking about early Metroidvania games. We got to the Metroid, we got to the Vania, we got to stuff like Wings of Medulla, and so on and so forth. Some things have happened since our last episode on Metroidvania games, though. Well, one thing has happened, and that is Nintendo announced a remake of Metroid 2, which is really cool. That's like the forgotten Metroid game that no one cares about, except then some fans did a remake of it, and I guess Nintendo was like, oh yeah, well we can do that too. So they did it, after a cease and desist. Do you guys have any thoughts on Return of Samus or Samus Returns?
I'm excited about it because I love Metroid. I mean, I love it.
Where do you stand on Metroid 2, though? That seems to be the divisive. Like, you know, every Nintendo game, the sequel in the 8-bit era was always, like, off-putting. Like, Castlevania 2, Zelda 2.
Metroid 2, I got it when it was relatively new, you know, when it first came out. And I was disappointed just because of the... I first thought it was pretty awesome, but the animations of the big clown shoes running around, just like, I can't take it. Samus has these big, like, she's like shuffling around.
Her animation's not the greatest, but is that really what ruined the game for you?
Yeah. I mean, the graphics aren't that great. I think they really screwed up Samus in that one, in my opinion.
That's actually kind of where they designed modern Samus.
Yeah. I mean, the ship was in that one first, right?
Right, but they totally overhauled her armor from the original game. The original is a Metroid. She was in a pretty slim suit of armor, not form-fitting, but very, like, it didn't have the bulk that the later Metroid games did. And they gave her, like, those huge shoulder
Yeah. Not pauldrons. What the hell are those? What are those things?
Epaulettes.
The bulbous epaulettes.
I think actually pauldrons might be the word for it.
Yeah. Might be, but those are some big ass pauldrons. They're like beach ball pauldrons. Beach baldrons. There we go. Okay, so she's got her beach baldrons. They added those to the sprite because they didn't have colors. Like on the NES, you know, when you get the Varia, your color changes. But in the Game Boy, they couldn't do the color change, so they were like, well, let's give her a different visual signifier. So they said, what about gigantic shoulders?
Yeah.
And that's how that came about.
So it's like the 80s with the big shoulder pads.
Right. She was basically like the female power executive, you know, probably had a pencil skirt also.
Probably. Well, that might explain the weird walk thing too going on. But
so it all comes together.
I was excited when the Game Boy Color came out because it sort of enhanced the colors of that game a little bit. You know, they had a built-in palette for that game, and you could actually see the action a lot better on that screen. And I remember playing it a lot after that. It's all right. I know you go from one of those Alpha Metroids or whatever they are to the next one, and you know, it's not as good as Super Metroid.
It's not. But then what is?
I'm actually really excited about it.
Castlevania Symphony of the Night is.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
That is actually true. But I mentioned the last time we were here talking about Metroidvanias, I was never a Metroid guy. Like, I was a Vania player when I was younger. The only way I've experienced Metroid 2 is literally from reading Jeremy's Anatomy of Metroid. I'm really interested in it because I'm never going to go back and play a Game Boy game, like, unless I need to for this show. So the idea of getting like a modern remake that, you know, isn't just like an HD remake, but preserves what works about Metroid 2 while also giving me a modern sensibility and a more modern way to play it is something that I'm really excited about because it's the ideal way for me as I guess a more casual Metroid fan to experience that game. Aside from reading a detailed book about it.
I'm curious to see how it's going to work just because Metroid 2 is the one Metroid game that Yoshio Sakamoto wasn't involved in. He was the director designer of the original game, the director designer of Super Metroid, Metroid Fusion, so on and so forth. Like the Prime games, he hasn't really been that involved in, but any of the 2D games, up to and including Other M.
What about Zero? Have all been... That Metroid Zero.
Yeah, Sakamoto worked on Zero Mission also.
I love that. That was a cool remake, you know.
It's a great remake.
Really good.
But Metroid 2, he didn't have any involvement in. Mm-hmm. That was a different section of Nintendo R&D 1. So I'm kind of curious to see how he's going to put his fingerprints on the game, especially because I feel like his game design sensibility has changed a lot since Metroid 2 was new. I mean, he was the guy behind Metroid Other M, which is a lot of people think is an abomination in the Metroid name. I don't think it's that bad. The story is bad, but the gameplay was pretty good, if not exactly what I expect from Metroid. So I'm curious to see if he can reconcile that sort of modern design impulse with, you know, the content and the structure and design and sensibility of the original Metroid 2, a game that he did not work on.
Really interested in the idea of this game that we consider to be part of like one of Nintendo's, you know, the three really core franchises of Nintendo, not counting Pokemon.
And Fire Emblem, Splatoon, and...
Well, yeah, yes.
Well, in America, I'd say Metroid is one of the cores.
Yeah, well, you know, Mario, Zelda, Metroid, those are kind of the three I'm thinking of.
And Kid Icarus.
But the second one...
Poor Kid Icarus.
The second one being a Game Boy game has always struck me as really weird because that didn't happen with anything else. You had, you know, Game Boy Zelda games, you had Game Boy Mario games. But with Mario.
It did actually happen with Kid Icarus.
Did it really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which was also by some of the same devs as Metroid.
Interesting.
Of Myths and Monsters.
So I can say, like, the reason that happened is because Game Boy was developed and kind of led by Nintendo R&D 1. Which was the same division that designed Metroid and Kid Icarus. Mm-hmm. So they kind of, you know, once the NES started dying, they sort of took their ideas over to the platform they were working on. Instead of developing these for Super NES, they put them on Game Boy. So that's why that happened. But I do agree. I'm right there with you. Like, it is kind of weird that this legendary NES game got its sequel on Game Boy.
Yeah, it's like imagining if Super Mario Land wasn't the weird offshoot franchise that it eventually became. Like, if that's where the core Mario series came from. Like, I think Metroid is really interesting as something that started on NES, then went to Game Boy, then went to Super NES. As you know, kind of, it's the one that hits all the consoles in its core storyline. I think it's really interesting.
Missed Super NES though, N64.
Yeah.
Was there no Metroid game for 64?
There wasn't.
I was disappointed.
It was 8 years between Metroid games, Super Metroid and Metroid Prime. Metroid.
Those were like the worst years of our lives, right?
It was a dark time.
It was.
I desperately clung to any Metroidvania game at that time because I was like, I need my fix.
Need some Metroid. Well,
fortunately, you did have the best one.
I mean, you can still see the track mark. It's terrible.
I see it. Yes. All the.
So if we look back at kind of the Metroidvania concept in general, I think what you find is that most of the sort of formative games in the genre happened on the NES. And I think that is just a product of kind of the times. Like, this is the time when platformer games were starting to go from single screen arcade things that, you know, you played for a high score to something more exploratory, adventuresome. At the time, the NES was basically the dominant system in Japan where most of these games were being made. In Europe, you know, there was still a lot of focus on PCs, and different styles of games came into being as a result. And in America, game development was really focused more on PCs, like American-style PCs as opposed to the British microcomputers. So they tended to go toward more of like the bigger, in-depth RPG-type adventures. Like, the games you hear about being made for the home market in the mid-80s in America tended to be more stuff along the lines of Ultima or Might and Magic and things like that. So I think just kind of as a consequence of the fact that the NES was dominant in Japan and lent itself to this style of games, you see most of these games sort of evolving on the NES and then some offshoots on like Master System or other consoles from other manufacturers, but mostly Nintendo systems.
Do you think that's a function of the NES being essentially defined by Super Mario Brothers? Because one of the things that you've written about and talked about before is that the structure of Mario Brothers isn't just like that it's so big, like compared to games that had come before, like, you know, the very idea of having, you know, 8 worlds of 4 levels each was massive. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they flow together and form a more or less cohesive environment, do you think that's where that idea really started to take root?
Yeah, I don't know if I necessarily say like people saw Super Mario Brothers and were like, oh yes, that's what we should do in that sense. But I do think that Mario was kind of a part of just an overall movement toward a different way of thinking about games, thinking about them as, you know, spaces and environments as opposed to, you know, like obstacle courses on a single screen. Again, you know, things were starting to turn into these more expansive, free-scrolling worlds. And so I think as a result, people started to, you know, start to think, like, is this a space? Like, can we define this? And Castlevania was one of the first games that really did that. And, you know, it gives you a map as you travel through the castle. So the little map that you're traveling actually lines up with the stages that you're completing. So there is a sense of like, oh yes, I am in this castle, and look, here is how I'm moving through the castle. So yeah, the idea of like video games having sort of a coherent geography, I guess. I don't know if that necessarily came out of Super Mario Brothers, but certainly Super Mario Brothers was part of that movement, that trend.
Yeah, I feel like Super Mario Brothers and Zelda defined that platform completely. So they, there were lots of platform clones, and then there were platformers that had adventure elements to them, which is kind of what we're talking about. And I think that came a lot from The Legend of Zelda once that came out.
Yeah, and Dragon Quest also. That was the other big game. Not so much here, but in Japan, like, there were so many games influenced by Dragon Quest. And once Dragon Quest came out and started to become big, then you start to see the actual RPG elements show up in these games, including Zelda 2.
Yep.
So we'll talk about some of these. Thank you. So in the last episode, we talked about some of these games, but then I cut that part because the conversation didn't really go anywhere. We had to cut it off.
So we're going to material.
That sounds like Patreon content to me.
cut to the replay.
Yeah, crazy. It was just like a bunch of us screaming at each other. It was yeah. But yeah, I would like to kind of go back and, if you guys don't mind, sort of recap some of this conversation, mainly about the Goonies 2 and Zelda 2, because those are kind of, in a lot of senses, the first games that I think really, that and Rygar also, kind of nailed this idea and do it cohesively and coherently and effectively.
Oh boy.
So, go on.
Rygar. I'm a big Rygar fan.
When you say Rygar, you mean the...
The NES version.
Okay, the NES version.
Although I do have a port... There's an arcade port of Rygar on the Lynx here. That's kind of neat.
Yeah, so one of the things that's maybe worth mentioning is that arcade conversions to NES were always different. Mm-hmm. And that was partially a function of Nintendo saying, if you are going to put a game on our system, it has to be unique. It can't be the same game that you would play on... you know, Master System or PC Engine or whatever, it has to be distinct. So developers would redesign their games, their arcade games, for NES, which some people hated. Like Double Dragon got its, RPG mechanics, and Bionic Commando became basically an entirely different game. Mm-hmm. Rygar also became an entirely different game.
Yeah, definitely.
So
so did Strider.
Strider.
And Ikari Warriors
Strider,
2, I was just
Strider wasn't
recently.
Actually a conversion of the arcade game. It was developed in parallel to the arcade game. But well, Rygar was definitely one of the first games that did this. I'm curious if you'd like to talk about the differences there and what the game
is. I mean, Rygar in the arcade is sort of like side scrolling. You beat up the enemies. I'm not sure your character progresses in any meaningful way.
No, it's very much like a Rastan Saga type game.
Yeah, so you're just, you're shooting monsters. It's completely side-scrolling view, and it's neat.
You have like a holy pizza on a chain?
Holy pizza, yeah.
And you...
What flavor is that pizza? What are the toppings on that pizza,
I think it's just, cheese. I think there's a power-up for pepperoni.
Spikes.
Spice?
Spikes.
Spikes. Oh, spike pizza?
Spike pizza, yeah.
It's the worst pizza.
So Rygar on the NES, though, was a non-linear action-adventure game where you can actually power up your guy over time and you find all kinds of artifacts, and it has two different perspectives. There's a side-scrolling part, and then there's the overhead sections where the sprite looks pretty much the same, but you see an overhead view while you're traveling between places, and it's just fun.
Yeah,
it
feels like this one was really heavily influenced by Zelda. But what I really like about Rygar, when you look at it versus the arcade version, is that it starts out with such a great fake-out. You're like, oh... It's a pretty nice looking conversion of the arcade game. You've got Rygar the warrior running, and there's the sunset behind him, and you're killing the same enemies from the arcade game. And then you get to the end of the stage, and you go to a different area.
Wait a minute. You can go up. Wait a minute, there are doors. Well,
you go to the different area, and then all of a sudden, like, this different area has ladders, and it has multiple paths. And then if you go into one of the doors, all of a sudden the perspective changes, and it's top down. And you're like, what the hell is happening?
Yeah.
What is this?
This is so awesome.
And if you pay attention, there's a subscreen that you can activate, and you go to the subscreen, and it's got like stats and equipment.
Yeah, and you can
magic spells.
You can build up a potion worth of health. If you kill enough guys and get enough health things, they turn into a potion or something like that.
You get a potion drop every once in a while, but the little stars that enemies drop
stars
are experience.
Are the experience. Yeah. And you get stronger and you can get more life.
You have mind and last. You don't have magic power and endurance. You have mind and last. But as those go up, then you can take more damage. Your magic becomes more powerful. You gain different magic spells, like the ability to recharge your health or to zap everything on the screen every time you attack.
Yeah, the equipment upgrades are cool. They function like the high jump boots or whatever they are, and long beam in Metroid, where they unlock new areas. There's a grappling thing that lets you go across two stumps to get to a new area, and there's like a vertical grappling thing, and then there's I forgot what. Lots of grappling things.
Yeah, there's some grappling.
Some grappling going on.
Those are kind of the main ones.
There's some others.
Yeah, there are some others.
I beat this game so many times as a kid, but I always did this cheat thing where my brother figured out if you... Or maybe we read it in Nintendo Power, where in the very beginning you can tape down the controller with a turbo button and you just like shoot nonstop to build up, you know, kill lots of enemies and get the XP and stuff to make yourself more powerful. And then the game is a lot more easy to play and more fun. But it's neat. There are these big bald guys in these rooms that tell you information.
They have I think those guys are called Endora.
Endora, yeah. And you can jump on enemies' heads and bounce off of them.
Actually, there's Endora, and then there are Hermits. And the Endora, Hermits don't have the third eye. Yes.
Okay.
The Endora are like the gods, and they're the ones who give you upgrades, like shields and things like that. Whereas the Hermits are just like, yo, what's up? Go save my daughter.
Yeah.
I don't think you ever see his daughter, though.
The bosses are cool, too. I remember one's like a lion thing with a...
That's the... Oh, well, there's a couple of them. Yeah, like the final boss is Liger. There's Rygar and Liger.
Liger, yeah.
But yeah, there is like this like three-headed lion thing.
It's neat. It's a great game. It really is. It's a little tricky at first, but if you stick with it, I think it's one of the better, most underrated Rygar games. In fact, I think I put that on my underrated NES list that I did for PC Mag.
Yeah, it's a really early example of developers stopping and thinking, like, how can we make this game unique and better suited for home play? Mm-hmm. And instead of just being, you know, like, the arcade game is like 64 levels that are all the same. It's actually really boring if you play mm-hmm. more than like 5 levels. It's just like the same thing over and over again. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is constantly giving you different scenery and different objectives. Every area has kind of its own structure. Like you go into the woods and the woods are very linear, but then you go into the mountains and you have to go up and down a lot and find passages and use the grappling wire and things like that.
And importantly, every area has different music too. So it's not like,
yeah, so the music is all very good.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. To me, this is kind of where Tecmo sort of started to define themselves as a developer, as a home console developer. They did something other than just the arcade game. And you saw that in, you know, games like Ninja Gaiden. Where they really did something different for home games.
Didn't they do Karnov?
That was Data East.
No, Data East.
And Karnov kind of does the same thing. I didn't include it in this because it's more linear, but they did add like this kind of adventure element to Karnov.
Well, Tecmo had Mighty Bomb Jack, right? Mm-hmm. And Solomon's Key, and I don't know. Anyway, Rygar is cool. It's definitely a proto Metroidvania.
Yeah, for sure. And that top down hub is interesting because it kind of, I guess it came out a little after Zelda 2 in Japan, and Zelda 2 did the dual perspectives, but this was, this is one of the first games that had the dual perspectives where you played in both. Like you could still do your platforming and attacking in the top-down view. It was a little awkward because of the perspective, and there were even some dungeons and bosses that you had to fight that way. So I don't know. I think it's a really great game. It's one that I meant to do an Anatomy of Games on, but never got around to, but There is a lot of interesting stuff happening in Rygar, and it's pretty dated now, but at the time, I don't know, like, I didn't know anyone else who liked it, but I borrowed it from a friend and played through it in, like, a weekend, but was just like, oh, this is really cool. I really like this. And it was another one of those games that I played early on in my NES-owning career that made me say, oh, yeah, I like games where you're traveling around and exploring and finding stuff and getting stronger.
It has unexpected depth. I think that was the most exciting thing about it back then. You know,
definitely.
You didn't expect it to have that much depth to it. What do you think, Chris?
I never played Rygar.
But you were just watching a video of it. What do you think?
I was. It looks really interesting. I think it's one that I was completely unfamiliar with before you started talking about it, but it seems like it is well worth going back to.
Yeah, it's one of those earlier, you know, it's a 1987 release in the US, I think. So it tends to be somewhat forgotten. I don't think people really paid a lot of attention to third-party games until stuff like Mega Man 2 and Ninja Gaiden and Contra started to come out. So it kind of got overlooked. But I think it's definitely one worth re-exploring, rediscovering. There's something to it. I like it. I think it's really well made.
Agreed.
Another kind of early game that came out around the same time as Zelda 2, at least in Japan, is The Goonies 2, which actually came out way before Zelda 2 here in America because of the Zelda 2 delays. But this was another one of the very first NES games that I borrowed from a friend, and it was not what I was expecting.
Yeah, and I liked, unexpected depth once again.
Yeah, I liked the movie The Goonies a lot. So I was like, okay, cool. I bet this is going to be dumb, a game based on The Goonies. And then I played it. It was like, wow, there's a lot happening here.
See, I had the opposite experience as a kid who, and I think it might be because I'm a little bit younger than you. But I was a huge, huge fan of The Goonies. It was one of my favorite movies. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kids looking for pirate treasure. It's a great concept. And you see that game box. I think we talked about this last time, too, that the game box looks like that Drew Struzan poster for the movie.
That was part of the stuff I cut, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Uh-oh. That's why I'm bringing it back up, because that is really awesome game box. Like, the art on that is super good. But maybe it's because I was so young. Maybe it's because I was expecting something completely different. I ended up finding Goonies 2 to just be completely confusing.
Like, it is completely confusing.
Yeah, when it would go into the weird little Shadowgate sequences, like I could not.
Shadowgate sequences. Okay, yeah, the first person thing.
Yeah.
The adventure scene.
Mapping is useful in this game too.
Yes. Yeah, it never occurred to me to like make a map of a game before because I was so used to
it. Game with its own map built in. On the subscreen, you go, and depending on which part of the game you're in, you get either a front map or a back map.
Oh, that's right.
I remember that.
And that's the part that kind of made me stop and say, what? Because I would, you know, pause the game, and it's like, front. It's like, oh, okay, so that's where I am in the game. I don't know why it says front, but there I am. I'm exploring. But then you go through the adventure scene to the, like, to the back side of the stage, or the backside of the world, and you get a different map altogether, and you're like, wait, what's happening? Mm-hmm. And then there are warp zones that take you to kind of unexpected places. So the areas that you're exploring don't necessarily line up physically with one another because you jump around the map and go back and forth.
So this was, what, 87?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would have been renting this from a video store like right after I got my NES. So the games I would have been used to would be like Super Mario Brothers. Mm-hmm. And it's such a different game in every way that I think I was just mystified by it and never, you know, when I got older, never went back to it.
Yeah, this was the first I ever heard of this was a Nintendo Fun Club newsletter. There was a feature, a 2-page feature on this.
Howard Phillips giving you the hookup on that.
He was. Howard Phillips. They didn't credit him. He was the secret gamer. But now I know it was Howard Phillips. But yeah, that article talked about how cool this game was. And I was like, huh, it's not what I would have thought. But it did look interesting. And so then I played it and I was like, yeah, there's a lot happening here. But something I think is helpful about The Goonies 2 is that if you look at the fact that it is The Goonies 2 as opposed to The Goonies, it kind of helps put some context into how platformers were evolving in this period of time. Because it's The Goonies 2 not in the sense of this is a sequel to the movie, but rather this is a sequel to Konami's previous Goonies game, which never came to the U.S. on console. It did make it out in arcades, but I didn't discover that until after I'd already played The Goonies 2. And then I was like, now I see.
Uh-huh. I was like 17 or 18 when I found it in a PlayChoice 10, and that was the first time that I knew that The Goonies 1 existed.
There was a pizza place that my family would go to like once or twice a month, Sunday after church, and we would just have pizza with friends, and they had a PlayChoice 10 there for a couple of years. The PlayChoice 10 had The Goonies in it, and this was after I played through Goonies 2. And I was like, oh, now I get it. Like, this is like the simpler version of Goonies 2. It didn't have the front back, but it was still kind of exploratory. The original Goonies for Famicom is based very much on the movie. Like, you start out in the Fratelli hideout, and then you go into the basement, and then you go into the caves, and then you end up on One-Eyed Willy's ship, if you can make it that far. And each of the six stages is sort of a self-contained space that you have to kind of explore and go back and forth, and you go into doors and kind of duck into the backside of the stage, and you have to collect bombs and open up vaults where Goonies are hidden, but there's also secret items that are scattered around invisibly, and so you can like acquire these semi-permanent power-ups like raincoats to keep the water hazards from hurting you and so forth. Football helmets to keep stalactites from falling on your head and hurting you. So it does have this adventure element, but it's within the context of a like level-by-level progression game. It's just that within each level there is this sort of exploratory, free-roaming element, and you have a limited amount of time to find the Goonies within that stage and to find the keys that you need to get to the next stage. And then once you have the Goonies rescued and collect all the keys, you can go to the next stage. And when you get to the pirate ship, then you rescue Andy, and hooray, game over.
Wow.
Yeah, I think
you're good at talking about video games. You should do this for a living.
I'll think about it.
I think my problem was that my after church pizza places all had Neo Geos.
Oh, wow.
So it wasn't like, cool. This is a little bit of a tangent, but there was a nice restaurant in the town where I grew up called Big Jim's. Mm. It was like a nice sit down place. But a thing that I didn't know, again, until I was a teenager, was that they had a separate restaurant called Big Jim's in the back that you had to go around, and it was like a diner, and that's where the Play Choice 10 was, which I didn't find out until
this
I was
is just like Goonies. It's got the front and the back. Right.
$100 bill.
I do think that if I would have had like a – I was not yet a Nintendo Power subscriber, and I never was on the – I wasn't early enough for the Nintendo Fun Club.
Blasphemy.
But if I had had something like that, I think I would have been way more into Goonies too. And I know that because I was like briefly and mildly obsessed with Star Tropics.
Mm-hmm. They are very much cut from the same cloth.
Yo-yo
games.
A character named Mikey who attacks with a yo-yo in both games.
Yeah.
It's not subtle.
Yeah. Well.
But the Goonies 2 was a very confusing game. And
yeah, well, let me tell you, didn't it freak anybody else out when the Goonies 2 came out? You're like, was there a movie about this that I was missed?
Was there a mermaid in the first? Mermaid. I heard there was an octopus, but I never heard anything about a mermaid.
A mermaid. No, I just thought there was some kind of sequel. It just, you know, before you could look it up on the internet, you'd have no way of knowing. You'd have to go to a video store, and if it's not there, you'd never know. I mean, it's literally, you would not know.
It didn't freak me out, but it did make me wonder. I was like, so is this like based on a sequel to the movie that never happened? I didn't know. It wasn't until I came across the original, you know, Goonies for Play Choice 10, I was like, okay.
It's one of those childhood mysteries that only falls into place when it all falls
into place.
Kids
these days have no idea because they can just go on Reddit.
It's the Mandela effect where people think Nelson Mandela died or something. They swear they remember it.
Yeah, but it never happened. I don't know if this is quite the same thing.
The Goonies 2 actually came out, everybody.
Yeah, it's not with the mermaid.
We're living in an alternate reality.
I'm thinking of Splash. Never mind.
It's weird, but it's almost plausible. Because Splash did exist. I had seen like Splash on like HBO. I knew that the Goonies existed. I knew that sequels existed. And yeah, they found pirate treasure and there wasn't really anything magical, but maybe in the second one there's a mermaid. And then it turns out the answer is just no, video game sequels were weird.
So there was a big problem with the Goonies 2 for NES, and that is that the instruction manual omitted a very important piece of information. So you mentioned the adventure scenes, you called them Shadowgate parts.
Shadowgate parts.
I think it's more like Dr. Chaos or something like that. But yeah, you're like a first person view and you basically have to kind of like find your way through and you collect an inventory and you only use this inventory specifically within these adventure scenes. They don't really come into use when you're running around. Like you can get eyeglasses and a ladder and stuff like that. That doesn't have any effect on the platforming, but when you're in the adventure scenes, which are just, you know, you looking at a room and trying to poke around and find secrets, like these things come into play. Well, there's a little too much inventory for a single menu. And so once you start to get items that overflow in the first menu, it goes to a second page. But the manual doesn't actually tell you how to access that second page. And so there was a part where you have to use a diving suit to go underwater from the adventure room. And I knew what I needed to do, but I would go to this room where there was a hole in the ground with water. I was like, well, I've got the diving suit. I found it, but it's not in the menu. What the hell's going on? It turns out there's a second page to the menu that the manual doesn't tell you how to use or tell you how to access. And you have to like press a specific button to do it. And I never knew what that button was. And I didn't realize that was how you did it. So it wasn't until like years later, like 2 or 3 years after I started playing this game, that I finally stumbled into, maybe I didn't even stumble into the information. Maybe it was just like I accidentally activated it or something. I don't remember, but it took me ages to beat this game. But once I figured out that second menu, then I was like, oh, okay. So then I went underwater and beat the game, and it was great. Mm-hmm. But that was a very...
Sounds like Batman Forever, where you had to push it down and up.
Kind of like that. You were in a real Batman Forever situation.
Yeah. But it wasn't even a situation where having the manual would have helped, because I had the manual, and it did not help. It just was not documented. So that was deeply frustrating.
Maybe that's one of those things they put in for game counselor calls, like you said that they did. In another podcast, you said I think it was just games more difficult, so you had to call it.
I think it was just badly written.
Incompetence.
Yeah. Okay. That's a shame.
Do you ever call like a game counselor?
No.
I didn't.
My parents wouldn't let me call those 900 numbers.
I did once.
I did once, yeah.
Maybe my brother did once, but not. I didn't do it.
And I wanted to make sure I had all the endings to Chrono Trigger. So I was like, you know, this guy keeps telling me that my friends are in trouble, but I feel like I've helped all my friends. What am I supposed to do? And they were like, I don't know. That cost me $5. And
I said, yeah, I had a
never again.
I don't know.
I had a very similar experience where I was stuck in the first level of the Spider-Man game for Super NES because you go down a flight of stairs, and the way the camera follows the visual cue that there's something under that flight of stairs, it doesn't go down far enough to show it. So I didn't know that you just had to like duck and press jump to get down and go fight Dr. Octopus. So I called a game counselor and he was like, I don't know, man, you should just be able to get to Dr. Octopus.
That's helpful. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the $5.
So next on the list here is Zelda 2, which I think is important to talk about.
I swear we talked about Zelda 2 for like an hour last
time. We didn't. We talked about it for a couple of minutes and that part got cut out.
Okay.
So.
Well, cut out this.
What did you say about Zelda 2 last time, Ben?
I don't remember. Let's go cut to the replay.
There is no replay.
Deadly Towers.
It was edited out.
I don't know. Zelda 2 is great. It's Oh, that's what I said. I said it's the most criminally underrated game of all time.
Didn't I say all time?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a bold claim.
I think so. Because, I mean, it is one of Nintendo's flagship franchise entries, but it's just so... It was so put down for so many years for being different when everybody wanted a top-down Zelda. I mean, I think in weird compressed time scales here, because I grew up living through this, and you know, it seemed like the time between waiting for Zelda 2 and A Link to the Past was like forever, and everybody wanted another top-down Zelda, but now that was probably like a couple of years or something.
It was, but yeah, I agree that there was kind of a sense of like, well, this game is a little weird, but I feel like we all kind of just accepted that because Nintendo kept making all those weird sequels like Mario 2 and Castlevania 2. And again, we mentioned this before, but
I think the problem with that is that Mario 2 is weird and different, but it still looks like a Mario game. And Castlevania 2 is weird and different, but it essentially looks like Castlevania.
Yeah, that's true.
Zelda 2 looks completely different.
Yeah, it's a different genre.
The color scheme is the same, and that's it.
You're a little guy. You've got an elf.
Yeah, but he's weird and tall.
It's punishingly hard in many places, but you can power up your guy. And I think we were saying also it was like that is a Metroidvania, essentially. Very, very well. I mean, it's a side-scrolling action platformer. You power up your guy. I don't know. It doesn't have a map. Jeremy, help me out.
Well, so I feel like what they did with Zelda 2 was say, like, you know, with the original Zelda, we made an action RPG, but what if we took it an extra step further? What if we made it more RPG and also made it more action? So it's like the more action, more RPG.
Mm.
So instead of being a top-down game where you're traveling like screen to screen, it became a side-scrolling game very much in the style of Mario or even more accurately Dragon Buster by Namco. Mm-hmm. And then the top-down view became sort of like the Dragon Quest style overworld. Yeah. I really feel like they saw what happened with Dragon Quest and were like, yes, we need to do some of that. But instead of just making a Dragon Quest clone, they said, what if we took the game that we made that was already kind of based in the RPG genre and made it more like that, but without going all the way? What if we kept the action element instead of having turn-based battles? So
we're putting a lot of words into Nintendo's mouth here.
We are, but I feel confident in doing that.
Okay, good.
Well, it also let
I've
them...
I've met some of them before, so I feel like I know
that
them.
That is awesome.
It also let them very clearly give players an idea of the scale getting ramped up, because one of the things you wrote about in Anatomy of Zelda is you can walk to where the first game takes place, and it's a very small piece of the larger adventure of Zelda 2. So they literally are like, well, if you like this, this is so much bigger.
Yeah, I feel like they really recaptured that in Breath of the Wild, where you start out on the plateau for the first few hours and you're like, oh my God, this is so huge. There's so much to do. There's so much stuff. And then you get the three items you need for the plateau. And the old guy's like, all right,
have fun,
kid. Go have fun. And then you look around and realize, oh, that was like 3% of the entire world. Oh my God.
All my weapons keep breaking and I keep slipping off the things.
Yeah, it turns out Breath of the Wild rules super hard.
It's good. But the Zelda 2 has strategy action where you can duck, you can block, you can, you know, jab high or low. There's a lot of, how would you call it? Just agility action strategy.
It is definitely a skill-based action game. Cool. It is not just a button masher. I mean, definitely I like you need to button mash some. But,
but you can't get through it just by button mashing. That's
no,
what's
but,
cool
but
about
it feels
it.
Like they said, you know, what if we took the side view of Mario, but then incorporated the elements of the original Zelda into that, where you are a guy with a sword and a shield. Like, how is that going to work? So, you know, when you attack, you drop your defense and you have two levels of defense because it's a side scroller and you can duck. So, yeah, it makes sense that you can, like, instead of just ducking, you're like lowering your shield and lowering your guard.
A thing that I think is really interesting is that when, you know, when Smash Brothers came out, that Link has the Zelda 2 attacks. Like when he does the up thrust and the down thrust.
Yeah, I feel I feel like up Zelda thrust. 2 was, I know I've mentioned this in a previous episode, probably the Ocarina of Time episode, but I feel like Zelda 2 was somewhat repatriated into Zelda canon with Ocarina of Time because so much of combat felt like an evolution of what you had in Zelda 2. A Link to the Past did not feel like that. It was like A Link to the Past combat works for a top-down view. It's really smart and really well designed. But Ocarina of Time kind of shifted the camera down from that overhead view to a behind the character camera view, which is basically like the Zelda 2 view, but rotated 90 degrees to be behind you instead of beside you. So I feel like all the things that they tried to do with Zelda 2 and didn't maybe succeed entirely, they were able to express that better when, you know, when you had that 3D view that was more liberated and not tied to a side-on perspective.
Yeah, so with the Zelda series, you mentioned Ocarina of Time, that those really great games tend to overshadow Zelda 2, which is why I think it's underrated anyway.
I agree, but I feel like we wouldn't have things like Breath of the Wild if we didn't have Zelda 2. I think that was an important experiment for the franchise and for Nintendo to kind of like say, can we explore these ideas in a different perspective? Does everything have to be top-down? Can this work? Can we have like a Mario-style game that also has RPG mechanics? And
and then they did the same thing with Ocarina of Time. It's like, can we make Super Mario 64 a Zelda game? You know?
Yeah. Like, but at the same time, it's also like Ocarina of Time is also extremely A Link to the Past. Yeah. Like most of the quest is basically a recreation of A Link to the Past.
Similar items and stuff.
Yeah.
I think we're boring Chris. He just...
he's asleep, but that's okay.
Okay. Sorry, we're just talking about Zelda
for an hour.
It's
good to take a nap sometimes.
Okay.
I got distracted looking for a map of Hyrule. That's all. Okay.
Yeah, but I feel like Zelda 2 is a pretty important step for the Metroidvania genre because it does incorporate actual RPG mechanics. You have, you know, free exploration and, you know, exploration that is sort of progressive based on your skills and utilities and things like that. But at the same time, your character levels up based on your actions. That's something you didn't really see, you don't really see in a lot of Nintendo games. Your power-ups are not so much item-based, but more like intrinsic skills.
Yep.
And you get experience for killing bad guys. So Zelda 2 is very much sort of the baseline for games like Symphony of the Night also.
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah.
And there's actually a whole bunch of the games on this list that really draw heavily on Zelda 2, maybe more so than any other game. So even though we talk about it being underappreciated, it actually had
influence.
I think not just influence, but I think it had, you know, like a big psychological effect on certainly other game developers who looked at that design and said, oh yeah, we should do that too.
Yeah. I think it was very influential without a doubt. But I was just saying it's underrated in the scheme of things as far as Zelda games are concerned.
Well, I think it's very similar to what happens with Castlevania 2, where Castlevania 2 isn't looked on super charitably, but you don't get Symphony of the Night without it. You don't get the
Order of
Castlevania games. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep.
Some people are really into racing games. They spend thousands of dollars on complicated simulated driving rigs with analog steering wheels and force feedback chairs. But most people tend to be a little more budget-minded with their gaming, and are okay with slumming it by sticking to their standard controller for racing. When it comes time to move from driving games to buying a real car, TrueCar can help you lock down the best of both experiences. A dream car purchase that's friendly to a standard controller budget. TrueCar connects you to actual sales data from a network of more than 13,000 dealers. Actual certified dealers who can hook you up with pricing information on more than 700,000 pre-owned vehicles. Using TrueCar means you don't have to worry about unpleasant surprises, like configuring the car you want online, only to learn that the dealer doesn't actually carry it. You can arm yourself with info on real pricing on actual inventory, plus all available sales incentives, before you ever make it to the dealer's lot. On average, TrueCar users have saved more than $3,000 off the MSRP of their dream cars across more than 3 million vehicles sold. So, when you're ready to commit to a new or used car, use TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
There are 120,000 unsolved murder cases in America.
It was the next day that I found out from my parents what had happened, that my sister was killed.
Each one is called a cold case.
Sometimes you have to look really closely to find the evidence.
Damn it, I killed her.
Cold Case Files, the podcast.
Garcia is walking into the home of a real monster.
I was nervous. I realized what kind of person I was dealing with.
It's a goosebump moment.
Download new episodes every Tuesday on the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.
When you were growing up, how many times were you told video games would rot in your brain? While the verdict is still out on this one, if video games do happen to have mind-destroying powers, hopefully our episodes of Retronauts will plug the holes in your gray matter with so many important facts. But if you're interested in a more scientifically sound way to stay your sharpest, consider Focus Factor. If you're feeling mentally fatigued or distracted, Focus Factor is the only double-blind, placebo-controlled, clinically proven brain health supplement on the market. Focus Factor is perfect for work, home, and school, and with its powerful combination of neuronutrients, vitamins, and minerals, it's designed to improve memory, concentration, and focus. And for the younger brains in your household, Focus Factor Kids Extra Strength helps support healthy brain function in children. Plus, they're chewable and available in a delicious berry blast flavor. Give America's number one brain health supplement a try and feed your Einstein. That's right, folks. There is a tiny German man living inside of your skull right now, and he is hungry. And now for you, listeners of the Retronauts podcast, Focus Factor is offering a special discount code. Just visit FocusFactor.com and use the discount code RETRO10 to receive 10% off of your order today. Remember, that's FocusFactor.com, discount code RETRO10.
Okay, so we kind of hit the sort of early 1987 Metroidvania games where things started to really take hold. And basically the games after this are kind of a, I wouldn't say reaction, but they're building on that. There are other developers looking at these sort of landmark works and saying, yes, let's take it a step further and see what happens. So I wrote things down in a certain order, but let's just skip that order and talk about first the Battle of Olympus, because no game is more like Zelda 2 in the world than Battle of Olympus. Well, that's not true. There was the Adventure Time game that was just basically straight up Zelda 2. But until that game came along, that was, hey, Ice King, where's my garbage? Why'd you steal our garbage? That's it. The Battle of Olympus was a pure Zelda 2 clone. Have you guys played this one?
I have. Not a ton. I have not. But it's a surprisingly good game.
It takes away the top-down RPG perspective, yeah, but everything else, it's basically like if Zelda 2 were just one entirely contiguous side-scrolling world.
Yeah. So in that way, it's more like a Metroidvania then, if it's all in one. Can it you is. Backtrack?
It's, yes, you have to at some point.
Well, the problem with Battle of Olympus is I never really played it as a kid. So I remember playing it about 10 years ago, and I was like, oh man, I wish I had had this when I was a kid, because I would have loved it.
I'm sure the developers wish you had played it when you were a kid, too.
Yeah, I'm sorry, developers. Who developed that anyway?
That was developed by Infinity.
Oh,
it was a never three. It was a three-person team. Infinity, I did an interview with the guy who runs the company now a couple of years ago. They're a really interesting company because basically, for the most part, they took American PC games and ported them to Japanese PCs. So they did stuff like Populous and Doom and that sort of thing, and they took those to the PCs that existed only in Japan.
Yeah.
And once Windows 95 came along and basically standardized all computer platforms in all regions, they sort of lost their reason for existing. They still make stuff, but they're basically a forgotten little company now. But this was, I think, Infinity's second game. Their first one was a Famicom Disk System game that's not very remarkable. But this, it was a three-person team. It was the company president, Yukio Horimoto, and his wife, and then a composer. And they put together a damn fine ripoff of Zelda 2. And he said, like, we wanted to make a game that we thought would be popular. And so we looked and said, what is a good game? What is a successful game that we can use as inspiration? And they looked at Zelda 2. And they did a really good job with it. It's a great-looking game. It's very challenging. It has, you know, like an RPG system in it. And it has a unique setting. It's set in ancient Greece. You play as, I want to say Orpheus. It's been a while since I've read the plot, but...
Orpheus.
That's right. You're Orpheus. Yeah, you play as Orpheus and you have to go to Hades and rescue Eurydice.
That is an interesting concept for a 1987 NES game.
Yeah.
Chris is going to write the comic book of that one, too.
I hope so.
That one's already been written.
Yeah. Edith Wharton beat him by about 100 years.
Oh, yeah. So. Ancient Greece. Okay.
But no, it's a really, it straight up uses Zelda 2's combat, where it's like, you know, high, low, swords,
up and down.
Sword shield. You have some magic spells. There's a currency in the form of ambrosia.
Interesting.
And yeah, like you travel, there's kind of like a world map that sort of tracks your progress, but you basically do all your exploration and adventuring within the side scrolling view. And, you meet up with God, you get stuff. Eventually you go to Hades and you have a fight that is pretty much a variant on the final battle in Zelda 2, where, you know, you fight Shadow Link. In this case, you're fighting Shadow Hades, but it's literally a shadow, and in order to be able to beat him, you have to have a magic item. So to beat Hades, you have to get this magic artifact that casts light, and it creates your shadow. So you're like fighting Hades in a side-scrolling view, and you can't see him. But once the light is cast, then your shadow appears and his shadow appears. So you're actually sort of fighting him upside down, because you're fighting like the shadowy, you know, image that's cast of invisible Hades. So there's some pretty cool concepts. It doesn't stray very far from Zelda 2, but it does at least put some inventive spins on Zelda 2. And again, it's a really nice looking game. It has a really kind of distinctive color palette, which is tough to do on NES because there were only like 52 colors. Mm-hmm. So having a game that has its own kind of visual style is a pretty remarkable feat.
Yeah, I'm watching a video of it now since we're talking about it. It's a really good-looking game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, the way that the color palettes move from screen to screen is really fun and distinctive.
This could be one of the most underrated NES games as well.
But is it more underrated than Zelda 2?
The problem is Zelda 2 is just one of the greatest games of all time.
Wow.
And a lot of people
you really feel that
don't
way.
Like it. So... it's a sort of relativity thing going on.
Well, also this
Olympus
game is extremely
is a clone
derivative
of Zelda 2, so it loses points for that, and it's not popular, but it's also good, so it's underrated. That's good. There you go.
So another game that I feel really drew heavily on Zelda 2 in a very surprising way was Pac-In Video's Rambo. Did you guys ever play Rambo for NES?
Yeah,
probably rented it at one point.
It is an open world game in which you control John Rambo fighting through the jungles of Vietnam to save POWs. And it's...
Power up your muscles.
You fight moths a lot. And then eventually you like, you know, the moths give you enough experience that you can start fighting tigers and VC and that sort of thing. Yeah. But
I remember I have a very small story, which is I bought this game used from a game store in the mid 90s or something. It's Rambo for the NES. And I played it for a minute and I'm like, this kind of sucks. But my brother started playing it. And then a day later, he's still playing it. I'm like, what's going on? This is, you know, I thought this was just a crappy game. So, but, you know. Tell us why it's great.
I don't know if it's great, but it's at least interesting.
Tell
and they
us
put
why
some,
it's
they
mediocre.
Put some effort into it. It's remarkable, if not great.
Yeah,
because
tell us why it's remarkable.
They basically turned this, you know, the jungles of Vietnam into an open world where you are traveling around and like there's little, occasionally you'll come to like little tiles in the ground that say N or S. It's like, I guess, north, south. So you go to those and you're basically like going into a door. So you go to a different part of the jungle. So it's this kind of very confusing labyrinth through the jungle. And there's, you know, swamps and there's the waterfall from the movie and there are huts and warehouses. And sometimes you have to fight, you know, like Soviet Hindi helicopters and things like that. You acquire different weapons throughout the game. You start out with just a knife, a trench knife, but you can get a bow and arrow. You can get a rifle. You can get grenades, napalm. Napalm's a little tasteless, I think, in the context, but is there a rocket launcher?
Probably. How can there not be a rocket launcher?
I think that's what grenades are for.
Russian attack.
I have two things I want to talk about with this game.
Okay.
One is that when it starts, Colonel Troutman comes to visit you and offers you the mission. And when he asks you if you want to accept, you are given the choice of...
Staying in prison.
choice one, I'm not afraid of death. Choice two, I feel better in prison, which is an amazing, like, that's way better than just a yes or no.
Yeah.
What happens if you hit, I feel better in prison? Is it an oh, but you must situation?
You can just stay there, but eventually if you want to advance the game, you have to go and leave prison.
The other thing is, what do you know about Pack-In Video?
They're a company not known for doing good things. This was maybe the
like
best.
They're evil.
Yeah.
If you've played some of their games, yes, games. you would agree that they are evil. This is probably the best thing they ever made. Certainly the most ambitious. Like it is a big side-scrolling open-world RPG inflected action game based on a movie that doesn't really carry that weight. Like most Rambo adaptations are just straight shooters, but this one is
fighting beetles and pelicans.
Yeah,
oh my gosh.
They struggled for some enemy concepts for sure, but does eventually you do upgrade to just killing people because that's what Rambo does best.
Yeah. Does he ever go oh and shoot 100 moths? At
I don't believe so. I think that was more of a Rambo 3 kind of thing.
Okay, yeah, that took place in a desert. There's no moths there, right?
Yeah, no, there's probably desert moths.
Okay, fine. I'm not a biologist. Come on.
But yeah, it's a strange game. I did play it through back in the day and finished it. And
how does it relate to Metroidvanias though? That's the big question.
I mean, it's an, like the jungle that you explore is open and you know, it's free.
Can
freely
you power
explored.
Up your guy other than
you
equipment?
You basically just have the weapons that you acquire. Okay. There are some keys to advancing and I can't remember exactly what they are, but it's still, you know, very much in the sense of like you have to travel around and explore and you can't go certain places until you're strong enough because you'll be destroyed. So it definitely has.
It says EXP right there.
Yeah, you have an experience system. Okay. Like you
so
gain
you
experience.
Get stronger. Yeah. So yeah.
Right. You get stronger, but you not in the not
this
in the
is
Metroid
an action
sense,
RPG.
Not in the Metroid sense where you're getting like double jumps and armor and stuff like that. Like you're always a dude without a shirt.
Do you do more damage?
I more believe so.
You know how there's Azure Striker Gunvolt, and then they made the kind of retro styled Mighty Gunvolt. This is like the Mighty Gunvolt version of Mercenary Kings.
That's an interesting idea. Is it Mercenary King kind of retro already, though?
It is. Mm. But so is Azure Striker Gunvolt.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Okay, so two more games to talk about, both of which come from the same developer or are part of the same franchise, and that is Legacy of the Wizard and Fazanadu.
Fazanadu.
Not Faxanadu, sorry.
It's Faxanadu.
It's not. It's Fazanadu, Famicom Xanadu. Both of these are variants of the Dragon Slayer series. Nope, not that one. It is a sequel. Well, Legacy of the Wizard is actually a Dragon Slayer sequel. I don't know if you guys are familiar.
Family.
Yep.
I love Legacy of the Wizard. It's one of my favorite games on the NES.
It is so bewildering. Tell us why you love it.
Because it's one of the 10 games we had when I was a kid, and we just were forced to love everything we had back then. We gave everything the benefit of the doubt, even if it was terrible, and tried to complete it because it cost $30, which is like $70 today in accounting to inflation. So, but Legacy of the Wizard, it has a lot of depth to it. You can play as one of, I don't know, four or five different characters, five, and you get a lot of neat items, and it's difficult in many places, but you can sit there and power up your guy and you get more, as in, I don't know if, I can't remember if there's experience. Is there experience?
There is not.
You just get more life and more magic containers.
Yeah, so
is this the one about the family?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I remember talking about this.
Yeah, so you start out.
We talked about it a little bit last time, but okay. You may have cut it out.
Yeah. So this is a weird one in a lot of ways, because basically you have this huge maze and it's like, I think, 256 screens total. It's just enormous.
Yeah, it's insane.
It's like 16 by 16.
That's what we talked about, because I printed out whenever the internet first came out.
Mm-hmm.
That was great. I got the disc and I put it in. Then I downloaded a map of Legacy of the Wizard that someone made.
That is a game that I would not want to map by hand.
Yeah.
Because it's,
that's why I never beat it, because you get lost so easily. I would spend days and days just playing that, never really getting anywhere. I don't know if I beat the bosses at all, but I would just play it.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about this game is that each family member has his or her own capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And like there are certain items that you can buy, and only a certain character can collect that.
Yep.
And basically the maze has like the central portion that anyone can explore, but then it has each of the four corners of the maze is an entire section that really can only be explored by one of those four characters. And you have to figure out, like, the game doesn't tell you which one.
Yeah.
You have to figure that out. You have to figure out which items the characters can specifically use, mm-hmm. what they're used for. Like, the hardest parts, I think, are with the father, Zemn, who has the ability to use the magic glove, which lets him move blocks around.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes like this block puzzle game. But it's kind of cumbersome. It doesn't work that well. I think the most fun character to play as is the dog, Poachy. Because the dog is a monster, and so monsters don't attack Poachy.
Yeah,
so
he can't get hurt by monsters.
Yeah, you can travel through, and like the only danger that Poachy has to worry about is falling from too high or dying to the boss, spikes, which is like a giant spider. That's like the only section I've ever beaten legitimately, because it's much easier. But then I think the mother can like jump high or float or something.
I can't remember. The girl can jump really high.
The girl can jump high.
And
the mother
can wear
float,
the spike shoes. I love the spike shoes. You can jump on monsters' heads and kill them.
And then that's there's fun. The son. And the only thing he can do is wield the Dragon Slayer sword.
Yeah,
so everyone else has to do all the hard work. And then they're like, okay, we found your damn sword. Go kill the dragon.
Yeah.
So you just go and you fight
legacy.
The dragon.
I shall do it.
I don't think the wizard even shows up. It's lame.
Like visually, it looks a lot like Goonies too.
Mm-hmm.
Like it has those kind of screens and those kind
except
of
except the characters are like really
tiny. Yeah, they're only one square
are, like,
high.
Little tiny like non Super Mario like cutesy sprites, which is pretty interesting.
Everything is it's a block system with those squares and the little guys fit in the squares of the game.
So my biggest complaint about this game. There's two of them. One is that just it's really, really full of unfair and punishing elements, like blocks that you walk across and will drop you and you'll lose like 10 or 15 minutes of progress and have to fight your way back. That really sucks. But also the system, there is no leveling for this. But basically when you go into the maze, you have maximum life, maximum magic, and then you have to collect keys. So anytime you attack an enemy, you use up a little bit of magic. Anytime you get hurt, you used up a little health. And the way the enemy drop system is arranged, like you're always most likely to get the things that you have the fewest of. So when you first start out, like you've got max life, max magic, no keys. So enemies are going to drop a lot of keys. But mm-hmm. then as you explore more, you get more keys and your life and your health or your magic start to drop out. So then you start getting a lot more health and magic drops, which is fine, but it slows you down. There's on the keys too. And gold. Yeah, also.
You get 1,000 keys and then you can finally get some life. There's like a key. So each block is 10 keys, right? And there's blocks of keys.
Is that
the
right?
The tops are like 10, groups of 10, and the lower thing is groups of 1. So every time you fill up the whole lower row,
blocks like 100. Up, yeah.
Or something.
Yeah, so anyway, the point is like there's a point at which you're not really making any progress on the stuff you have to collect. So it gets really frustrating because the game is just dropping like this succession of magic refills and you really want keys or you really want health.
I remember playing this game and getting really far lost in some place. And I was just, I couldn't believe how far I got, but I was terrified because I was low on health or something. And I knew if I died, I had to go back or start over. And it's a crazy feeling for a kid
being trapped in a corner. There is like a warp rod or something that you can use, but if you don't have one, then too bad. And there are inns that show up throughout the maze. Oh, the enemies also like to drop poison at you.
Yeah, they drop poison with skull on the top of your health.
Yeah. It's a really brutal game. I mean, it's very much from the Falcom tradition of games that exist to basically put you through the ringer and make you feel bad about life.
I still feel like it's a competent game, though. It wasn't a bad game.
No, it's not. It's not bad. It's just brutal.
It's just hard. Yeah.
That idea of having like characters that are specifically built for sections of the map, and that being the way that you chart your progress is like a really interesting idea. But it's one of those NES games that starts with that interesting idea and then makes it hurt.
Yeah. Well, it was actually originally an MSX game, but the NES version came out shortly after. So maybe that's why it is the way it is, because it was designed for a computer and people were just expecting computer games to hurt you.
Mm-hmm. It says on the is this the one that says on the title screen it's developed by Broderbund?
It was published by Broderbund in the U.S., in Japan, I want to say it was published by like Namco or something.
Oh, wow.
And the developer is Falcom?
Nihon Falcom. And I think Compile worked on the NES version. Yeah.
And this was Dragon Slayer 4.
Right.
The Drazzle family or whatever.
The Drazzle
Japan.
Family.
Yeah.
Drazzle. Or I think actually Drossley.
Drossley.
And I've never played Dragon Slayer 3, but I think Dragon Slayer 2 was Xanadu. So Fuzanadu is the Famicom variant of Xanadu and is nothing at all like the original Xanadu, but it's still part of that family. But that one was actually developed by Hudson and is a much more, I think, reasonable and fair game in the Zelda 2 mold. It also has a very unique look. It's very brown.
Are we talking about Faxanadu now?
Yes, Fuzanadu.
Fuzanadu. Yeah.
It's wild that it's a portmanteau that includes Famicom, which is already a portmanteau.
Right. Wow. It's Family Xanadu.
Family Computer
Except
Xanadu.
Dragon Slayer 4 is the family game. I don't get it. It's confusing.
Yeah.
It
should be we need Famicom hardcore. The Hardcore Gamer. Hardcore Gamer has a great article about these Dragon Slayer games.
Yeah, actually,
I've read about 5 times. It's really fun.
As a matter of fact, we'll be presenting a live panel at Long Island Retro Expo in August. So maybe after this episode airs, and Hardcore Gaming 101, Kurt and Xerxes will be showing up, and we'll be going through the Dragon Slayer series.
Wow.
So people can look forward to that.
We'll
actually explain what the hell is going on in the series there. But Fuzanadu is much more of a, like, oh, yes, a human could reasonably beat this game. It's very much in the Zelda 2 style where you're a dude. You can't do the ducking thing, though. Like, in the original, the early going of the game, if you want to kill an enemy that's not tall enough or that's not high enough for your sword to hit, you have to, like, use a magic spell.
Just fall over and hit it on your side.
You can't do that. You can't fall over. It's terrible. There's no low crawling in baseball.
We rented that when it was new, you know, in the early days of the NES, and we didn't like it, me and my brother.
Really?
So, yeah.
I thought it was pretty good.
I remember about it. And I've played it since then, but I don't like it that much.
That was when Nintendo picked up in the US and tried to publish and give like the same vibe as Zelda. Like the box was like kind of a tan version of the gold Zelda box.
Yeah.
With a crest on it and everything. Mm-hmm. It didn't have the cutout, it didn't have a gold cartridge, but they were still going for like
it's
a premium RPG experience kind of vibe. Yeah.
Well, the Zelda box was so incredible with the cutout with the gold thing.
Right. So they were definitely going for that, but didn't quite work. And Fuzanadu is not quite as good as Zelda, but it is good.
Not, yeah.
It's a more linear adventure. It's not quite as free-forming. There's backtracking, but not as much as in like Zelda 2 or even Rambo, honestly.
Yeah, gosh.
But you're traveling through...
Nothing's better than Rambo.
Hell yeah. You're traveling through the world tree trying to fight an infestation of dwarves who are killing the world tree and bring life back to the world tree to, you know, make all the elves who live in little towns in the tree's branches happy again. Which sounds... That sounds more like...
A twisted Disney movie?
Yeah, like a lot loopier than it actually is.
It should be dwarfs, like in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and you fight all the dwarfs. That would be cool.
The dwarfs
instead
are like...
Tolkien dwarves.
Weird, distorted, bizarre creatures, like bulbous-looking creatures with long, spindly legs, and I don't know what else.
This is disturbing.
It's a really... It has kind of a weird aesthetic to it. But you acquire better armor as you go. And it's one of the first games I can remember playing where your character's appearance changes as you acquire better armor. Like you start out as just a dude in like a leather tunic, but by the end you've got like this like total steel plate armor and this huge sword with like spikes on it and the big helmet with feathers. And you're like, I'm going to go kill the dwarves.
Badass. Yeah,
pretty much
kill the dwarves.
And it has great graphical effects like swirling fog and, I don't know, like they do a lot with the color brown. Everything is brown until the very end of the game when you bring life back and then it turns green again.
So it really is the forerunner of modern games.
Yes.
It is.
Early
2000s. It was the first Unreal Engine game. Clash at Demon Head, because man, I love that game. I don't know if it's actually any good, but I love it. Do you guys love Clash at Demon Head?
I can't remember which one it was. Like, I'm sure I played it.
Oh my god,
Chris, look it up real quick.
I am looking it up right now.
Chris, how could you not know Clash at Demon Head?
I'm familiar with Clash at Demon Head.
Okay,
passingly,
glancingly.
Does this have anything to do with demon heads?
It does not.
Clashing at a place called Demon Head?
There is a place called Demon Head.
Okay, a geographical place called Demon Head.
Hence at Demon Head. Yeah. So basically, this is a game that takes place on... There's like a world map, and it's broken into lots of different zones. And it's interesting because you don't travel... Like, you don't explore the zones themselves. The entire game takes place in the routes connecting one zone to the next. Hmm. So the zones basically are like... When you get to a zone, you basically go back to the world map and then you choose like which route do you want to take, and then you fight through that route through a platformer. So it's not like a contiguous world in the Rambo sense or the Goonies 2 sense. Well, I guess Goonies 2 is kind of broken up a little bit.
Oh, it's a Vic Tokai game.
Yeah.
I think this is the one that got us super off track when we last talked, because I was obsessed with the idea of being a member of the team called Saber, which is the Special Assault Brigade. For real emergencies.
I don't think we even talked about that.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
We might not have, but I remember being like delighted by that acronym.
I love about Clash of Demon Head, the reason it really sticks with me is because it was one of the first games from Japan that didn't really try to obscure the fact that it was from Japan. Like it has a very loopy sort of 70s shonen adventure anime look to it. Like there's these cutscenes where your dude has just got like the big spiky hair. Like it could be, you know, the bastard offspring of, I don't know, Captain Harlock or something.
Super Shop.
Amazing.
And it doesn't try to hide that for the US version. They didn't redraw the characters or airbrush. Well, they did airbrush the cover and it looks terrible. Hmm. But it feels like this game should have been based on some sort of anime property from the 70s. But I have looked and I cannot find any indication that this game is based on something. It's basically just an homage to, you know, the goofy, hyperactive boys cartoons that Japan had in the 70s. It's like kind of a retro homage.
Known in Japan as Dengeki
Big Bang.
Big Bang.
Because your character is Billy Big Bang Blitz.
Right.
Which is, again, delightful.
This game is why localization was invented, because I think I couldn't connect with it. As a kid. Too Japanese.
That's too bad, because I thought it was interesting. I was like, wow, this is like a crazy cartoon. I have no idea what this is, but it's weird, and I like it.
Although I watched Robotron and Voltron and stuff, and I had no idea those were Japanese shows when I was a kid. It's like, man.
But didn't you recognize like the visual style of Billy Big Bang Blitz as being like this, you know, spiritually connected to Rick Hunter?
Probably.
Or...
yeah, in retrospect, I probably did when I was like, you know, 6 or 7
Hikaru
years old.
Hikaru Ichijo,
like,
or whatever his name is.
It's just like Rick Hunter.
Yep.
Oh, I don't know.
So anyway...
I never played that game that much, really.
Okay, so the structure of this game, you know, you have the world map in like Super Mario Brothers 3 or Bionic Commando, and this has that kind of design, but it does some really interesting things. For one thing, there's no such thing as a bottomless pit in Clash at Demon Head.
Oh, I like that.
If you fall into a pit, like you kind of do this transition, yeah, and then you end up in a cavern, and you're kind of like off track a little bit, and you have to fight your way back. But you never die if you fall into a pit. Now, if you fall into lava and you don't have the super suit, you'll die. But eventually, when you buy the super suit, you can go into lava and explore in lava. So there's no such thing as a place that is out of bounds in this game. You can even get a jetpack and fly up to find
stuff
in the
sky. It's like Minecraft. And
no, it's really not.
It's exactly like Minecraft. That's all you need to know, kids.
I really love the enemy designs in this game. They're also like big.
Weird.
And weird.
There's like a panda on a motorcycle. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Now
it's
I like
skeleton
this game. Skeleton dudes.
The Billy Big Bang Blitz lives an interesting life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's all just all kinds of weird stuff. Like as you explore through the game, eventually you find your partner who's gone missing and he's been like mortally wounded. And if you go back to him later, he's dead. And you can like meet up with people who are, you know, NPCs and will talk to you. And if you shoot them, they shout no, but you don't actually hurt them. And there's a shop in the game and it appears in a certain location, but you can also summon it and it like flies in. And then you go into the shop and it's like this kind of chubby middle-aged dude, kind of like Torneko from Dragon Quest IV, and his daughter's there. They like sell you stuff. I don't know. It just has a lot of personality.
I also really like that instead of like money bags or coins or something, you're just picking up dollar signs, because everything is weirdly reduced to a conceptual level in the world of the Clash at Demon Head.
But yeah, it's just a game that you really need to explore, and you can eventually acquire better items to let you explore better places. And there is a plot to it, and you do have like this progression that you have to undertake, but you kind of have to figure that out as you go along. And then eventually you have to stop a bomb from destroying the world, and then the demons are like, ah, we'll get you next time, humans. You've defeated us for now, Billy Bang Blitz.
And when night comes, you have to build a shelter. The zombies will get you.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, and also the end of the game exhorts you to use science correctly, which I think is a very inspirational message. Anyway, it's a really great game.
Are you listening, Elon Musk?
Boom. Really, really going after the billionaires. Enemies of Retronauts.
Dude, we're everyone's friends enemies. With us.
Did you guys ever play the NES version of Strider?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe you guys can talk about that, so it's not just me monologuing.
No, not really, because it was mostly my brother playing it. So.
It was one of those games that I couldn't get too far into, just because I feel like I was bad at it.
Yeah, it's hard.
I felt like I was good at video games as a child.
It's kind of
really
a janky game.
Yeah.
When it came out, I was like, man, this game looks awesome, because the box was really cool and everything, and this is the coolest new game that came out. Did Nintendo Power have a feature on Strider?
Probably.
Because whenever it was a cover game, you know, we were really excited about it. So
I can't remember if they did a cover on Strider.
Yeah,
they must have.
I remember, but... I anticipated it somehow. Well, we would go to the cycle is you get Nintendo Power, you read it, you go to the Blockbuster, you rent it, you know, is it good? Yes, you buy it, or you rent it again and beat it again, or no, you don't buy it. So
Strider's a weird one, because the arcade game and the NES game were developed sort of in parallel, and they share some common locations and some common characters. But the NES version is actually based on a comic that was being written at the time. So it's meant to be like a tie-in to a manga. The weird thing is, though, that the manga of Strider never came out in the US, and the NES game never came out in Japan. It was supposed to, but it was canceled. So there's like this media tie-in that never actually connected because of, I don't know, bad choices or something. But the arcade game is like this cinematic adventure. It's very linear. Like every single screen is just a crazy balls to the wall action experience. You're just like, what's going to happen next? Oh my God, it's a robot dinosaur. Ah, the Amazons are killing me. Ah, I'm blowing up a spaceship. Ah, I'm flipping through zero gravity. Whereas the NES game is more of a measured adventure, you know, non-linear. You're exploring, go to different places. You have a home base that you warp to, but then you have to go back and forth into different spaces, get better key cards.
Are you talking about the arcade one right now?
I'm talking about the NES one now.
Good. The key cards.
Yeah, the key cards don't exist in the arcade game. Arcade game is just like, go for it.
Beat 'em up. I play the Genesis version of this game later after the NES version. I was confused. I was like, this is a totally different game.
Yes.
Because it was like the arcade game.
Then the more recent Strider was also like Metroidvania style.
Yeah, the more recent Strider, the one that, was that Double Helix who did that?
More recent Strider.
That was like the 2014 painter. Game. That was I feel like they really took a lot of inspiration from the NES version, but it plays a lot better than the NES version, although it is very repetitive because the scenery all kind of looks the same and there's no quick travel throughout the world, so there's a ton of backtracking, and after a while you're just like, I'm so sick of backtracking.
One thing that I think the NES version of Strider did really well, and a thing that was really appealing to me even though I was bad at it, is that it has a feeling of motion and quickness to it. Because Strider's got his high knees going, his cool knees.
Heineken? Oh, right.
His cool run, his cool Naruto run.
Yeah.
And his attacks just happen so fast that even if it's even if it was not a game I was good at, it made me feel like it was absolutely my fault because this guy knows what he's doing, clearly. Yeah. There's no, there's no Simon Belmont drawing back the whip before you attack. It's all as soon as you hit the
flash.
Button.
Yeah, I remember that. Well, that's cool. But what else is on our list?
Well, the problem with the NES version of Strider is that it's not very well made by Capcom standards. Maybe that's why it never came out in Japan, but Capcom always made really high quality games. This one is weird. It's like, it's a cartridge, but sometimes there's loading time.
Weird.
You're like, how do you get loading times on an NES cartridge? What did you do?
Yeah, maybe they're generating something random.
No, not really. It's for simple things like you beat an enemy and then you go to a preset location with a key card. And then there's 3 seconds of black screen. And then it's like, oh, you got your thing. So, yeah, I feel like they did not finish that game and just kind of got it out for release in the U.S. It's really weird. But yeah. But despite the jankiness and you're supposed to be able to do wall jumps, Batman.
Yeah, the wall jumps are
really hard to pull.
Very difficult.
Like Super Metroid's wall jumps are tricky, but Strider's is just why will this not work for me?
They're inconsistent. Is the big problem?
It's a pain in the butt. So I recently did a micro episode on Blaster Master when Blaster Master Zero came out, the great remake. So people have kind of heard my opinion, but it is one of the great NES Metroidvania games. Surely you guys have played this one.
Yes. I have a story.
Okay.
Blaster Master?
Tell us about how this game inspired you to buy a pet frog.
Yeah. I just caught him in the backyard. I didn't need to buy him.
It was right next to the radiation tank, right?
Yeah. Then they grew gigantic, and then I had to go rescue them or something.
Frogs are the worst, man.
But when NES games were incredible pieces of culture that every child lusted after, sometimes we'd first hear about them in the Sears toy catalog or something. There'd be a little picture. And Blaster Master was one of those games that came out sort of before Christmas or something one year. Or earlier before, and my parents ordered it for my brother, and we got it really early. So we had it the earliest in our whole neighborhood, in the whole city, it seemed like. So we felt we were so awesome, and it was a damn good game. So it doubled the excitement. And It's just the production values are second to none in this game for NES games. You know, just the Sunsoft hit every single note perfectly of the music, the sound effects, the graphics, the animation, the smoothness, the monsters, the design. You know, there's so many neat things about it, and it was too difficult for me as a kid to get past a couple, maybe three or past the first three levels or something, worlds. But, you know, my brother played it a whole lot, and I'd watch him play it. But I like the overworld thing. It's got an overworld, I mean, not an overworld, it's got an overhead perspective when you can hop out of your little car, you can go down into little doorways, and then you switch to an overhead perspective. And
it's worth mentioning that most of the game takes place, like the action sequences take place while you're driving a tank.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a shooter like that. But then you can jump out of the tank and you're like...
It's called Sophia, right?
Sophia the Third. But then you jump out of the tank and you're like 5 pixels high and you're running around as your little dude. And you're basically helpless. But then you go into those doors and it becomes the top-down view.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. Kind of like The Goonies 2 in that most of the actual game advancement happens not in the main view, the action sequences, but in those top-down views. Like, all the bosses, you fight them in the top-down views. Like, you could probably paste all of them in about 3 shots of your tank, but you don't get to fight them in your tank, so you have to go hop out and walk around in that top-down mm-hmm. Zelda style.
Yeah, I thought that was really neat, because the graphics are great in the top-down view, too. And there's a cheat where you could... Where Chris is watching a video of the first boss battle, where you could push select or start and pause it while you grenade him, and then it would just keep damaging it while it was paused, and then you unpause it.
Yeah, there's like 3 or 4 of the bosses that you can do that with, but you can't do that with all of them, including the final boss, which is a shame. It'd be nice to just cheat through him.
The bosses are gigantic in that game, which is another thing that was exciting back then. There's like a giant frog, a giant crab, I think, and there's that brain squid thing we were just looking at. And it's just a great game. It's one of the signature NES games, in my opinion, just especially third-party games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea of having this, like literally riding around in a tank and then having to make yourself vulnerable it seems so antithetical to the way that a lot of video games play. Like, once you're in the tank, you don't get out.
Right.
Blaster Master kind of forces you to depower yourself in order to advance.
Look at that screen. When you pause, you see a side view of the tank. That reminds me of what they did in Super Metroid later, mm-hmm. where you see a diagram of your suit, and so mm-hmm. like a wireframe thing with upgrades. Yeah. And you can upgrade your tank. And the cool thing about the tank car thing is it was just amazing. You know, for a kid, like a little boy, if you like cars and tanks and stuff, that was such a neat invention. It's so well designed with the giant cannon in it. And Nintendo Power had this poster or something that was... Somebody made a 3D model of that tank thing, and they had a picture of it. Mm. And Nintendo Power was just really cool. They did a great spread on that game.
One thing I really like is that the two views of the game are really nicely interconnected. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't advance in the game unless you get out of the tank and go do the top-down views. And then, you know, the equipment that you acquire in the top-down views empowers your tank. And, you know, that's where the Metroidvania element comes in, because your tank becomes progressively more powerful as you advance. Your character never really grows in power unless you, you know, get weapon drops. Gun. But those are very fragile. Like, if you take damage from an enemy, you
lose them.
You depower a level of your gun attack, which actually is kind of crappy.
Yeah, it
is. But that's like the one big weakness in it. Something they fixed for Blaster Master Zero, which was nice. But... The power-ups you acquire in the game are pretty unique, actually. You get things like, you know, you have a more powerful cannon, but then you have the ability to, climb on walls, mm-hmm. which you get actually after you gain the ability to hover. And you would think, well, you know, like being able to drive around the walls is not as good as the ability to fly. But what, you know, your tank has kind of like a horizontal orientation. Mm-hmm. So there are areas you can't actually fly up to, but then if you turn sideways and drive up the wall, you're able to fit through that crack. So they do a lot, you know, then there are spaces where you can only pass through if you're out of the tank. So they do a lot with kind of like constrictive spaces and really kind of designing the game world that way to gate things based on how you can fit physically into a space. But then you also have things like the dive booster, where you can swim around underwater in the tank. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a really smartly designed game. I don't quite get the gun depowering thing. It just seems so unfriendly compared to the rest of the game, but I guess they needed to make it difficult somehow. Yeah. But it holds up really well, and like the Switch and 3DS remake definitely adds to the game, but fundamentally it is the same game, and it's still really great in 2017.
Yeah, it's working.
And the idea of like improving your mobility is one that's so central to the Metroidvania concept. Mm-hmm. Like if you think about Symphony of the Night or mm-hmm. or Metroid, like the enhancements that you get and the upgrades that you get are often, you know, secondarily used for combat. And then primarily it's, you know, you don't turn into a bat in Symphony of the Night because you want to fight somebody as a bat. You do it to fly around, or that's why you get the big super jump. You know, it's all about
to get somewhere else.
Yeah. It's all about mobility and moving around.
It's a lot like Metroid in a car.
Yeah.
The first Metroid plus the top down scenes.
Yeah. In a sense, definitely. It's like Metroid meets Zelda in a sense with the top down views. Although the dungeons are a lot simpler in Blaster Master.
There are a lot more spikes in Blaster Master too.
You know, last time we talked about Metroidvania games, we talked briefly about Wing of Medulla, which was also a Sunsoft game. And the difference in, these games came out like 2 years apart. The difference in technological capabilities within the space of 2 years, like the standards that they were working to, like you wouldn't recognize Wing of Medulla as coming from the same company as Blaster Master, but it's like the same people probably. I don't know exactly who worked on which games, but this was Sunsoft kind of achieving the ambitions that they clearly had back when they were working on games like Wing of Medulla and Atlantis No Nazo. Like they wanted to make these big grand adventures, but they kind of sucked because they just didn't have the technical chops. Well, here they have the technical chops. And games like Blaster Master and Batman really made Sunsoft like a company to watch for during the NES era.
And there's Fester's Quest, which was like the whole top-down engine from Blaster Master.
Yeah, I kind of feel like Fester's Quest sort of misses the appeal of Blaster Master.
Yeah, it does. It's all over the place. But the funny thing about Blaster Master is they on Blaster Master 2 for the Genesis, I think they got rid of the top-down stuff.
No, it's only top-down, isn't it?
No, that's Blaster Master Boy.
It. Yeah, okay.
For the Game Boy.
No, they kept it on Genesis.
They did?
Yeah.
I don't remember the top-down in the Genesis.
Yeah, because I can definitely visualize like the more developed Genesis-style graphics with the top-down view. Yeah, Blaster Master 2, I've never played much of it, but people don't think it holds up as well as the original.
Yeah, it's not as good. It was one of those things that really flew under the radar, and I had to get it later. I was like, they made a Blaster Master 2? Wow, why didn't we ever play that? Oh, because it was on Genesis.
Oh, because it sucked.
Yeah, that's the way I talk back then.
Yeah, but definitely, if you haven't played it yet, definitely check out Blaster Master Zero, which is available for 3DS and Switch, and I think maybe coming to Steam. I don't know, but everyone should have one of those systems because this is Retronauts. Final game we'll talk about, and it looks like this episode is not going to cover the full set of notes that I wrote up. There's a whole lot of other games that, oh my god, yeah, we got like halfway through these notes. Okay, but this episode is basically
better than the third you predicted.
That is true. That's true. So I guess there will be a third episode. Oh wow, sweet Jesus!
Blaster Master.
Why would they do that?
Yeah, so it has a whole side scrolling instead of overhead. Oh boy.
All right, so one last game to talk about. It looks like this episode is just going to be NES Metroidvanias. So let's talk about a game that kind of ties it all back together, and that is A Boy and His Blob, developed by Absolute Entertainment. Design led by David Crane.
The legend.
Who basically got this whole thing started with Pitfall. So, Pitfall, and then Pitfall 2 took it even further. And A Boy and His Blob, much to my surprise, when I went back and visited it like 2009 or so after never having given it the time of day before, I was like, oh, there's a lot of this same DNA in this game. I did not realize that. But even though it's like kind of a level by level game, there is a lot of free exploration within those levels, especially like the main level, which is this huge underground cavern that's pretty much inspired directly by Pitfall 2.
I feel like this is not a Metroidvania.
It's definitely inflected. Like it definitely kind of dabbles. Like it dips its toe into the same pool.
It dips its toe into the platforming, yeah, with some limitations, and you get some jelly beans that give you different abilities. Your blob, but I feel like this is sort of its own genre unto itself because I don't think you can even jump in this game. So it's not even really a platformer. You have to use your blob to get around everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, you're using the blob to get to platforms.
Yeah, but you're going so up and down on a ladder form.
Would you consider Bionic Commando a platformer, even though you can't jump?
Grappling
arm. Platforming doesn't have to have jumping. It just it's about managing two-dimensional space with verticality.
Yeah, okay.
And
Blaster Master.
The blob is important for that because it is like the trampoline and the ladder and things like that.
Blaster Master has proxy jumping.
Proxy jumping.
Proxy jumping. It's not real jumping. It's just kind of like jumping, but you get to it through a different mechanic. There you go.
I only recognize games that have a pogo cane mechanic.
Pogo cane.
As true platformers. Are either of you familiar with the superhero Ultra Boy from the Legion of Superheroes?
I am not.
The gimmick with Ultra Boy, he's a Legion of Superheroes character created in the 50s or early 60s.
Is this a DC comic?
It's a DC comic, okay. Yeah. He has all of Superman's powers, but he can only use them one at a time. Okay. So if he's flying, he can't be strong. If he's using his penetravision, he can't be bulletproof. That's brilliant from a storytelling standpoint because it forces you to do, like, to create setups where he's being challenged in different ways at once. A Boy and His Blob does that with the character. Like, we talk about Metroid and Castlevania, and those are games where, and Zelda even, those are games where you continually acquire and build on things. You get all the funny shaped keys. You know, you can use the hookshot and the bomb and the boomerang. You just have to switch back and forth. You can turn into a wolf and then turn into a bat in Symphony of the Night. With A Boy and His Blob, you have to pick the specific thing that you do at that moment in time. And I feel like that necessarily slows down gameplay, but in a way that speaks to a very thoughtful design. And I find that really appealing, even though I am, you know, my usual goal in those games is to find the way to kill enemies the fastest.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The interesting thing about a boy and his blob is not only that, but also it kind of offsets your skills. You, as the boy, are not actually doing the things that you need to do to complete the game. You're relying on the blob, your companion. Like, the boy can't do anything. He's just like this stupid little schmuck with a backpack and jelly beans. But there's this little blob thing that is basically indestructible and can transform into any shape you can imagine, even like primitive mechanisms like a jack. If you give him an apple jelly bean, he turns into a jack because apple jack. It's a pun. Ha ha ha. Mm-hmm. That's how alien biology works.
Didn't get that until just now.
There you go. So it kind of turns the idea of exploratory platforming into a puzzle, and it's really interesting. Like, this is not a Metroidvania in the traditional sense of the word, but it definitely kind of, you know, taps into that same spirit. And then says, what if you did it a different way? So it stops being so much of a pure action game and becomes more about...
It's a puzzle.
Puzzle solving, yeah.
Kind of a hybrid puzzle platformer, but I don't think there's any character progression. There's no leveling up. There's
no but
know?
I mean...
So it's like, not like Metroidvania.
I don't think you're going to... I don't think there's any percentage in being too particular about a made-up word.
What do you use vitamins for?
We all have to agree on what a word means, or there's no point in talking about it.
Well,
because if I say cheeseburger and you think hot dog,
well,
then
it depends
what's
on
the
what
point?
You. I've been to a place in Wilmington that actually makes burgers in the shape of hot dogs. So there you go.
That's where we should record the next Restaurant Autiste.
I'm hungry now. Let's go there. Yeah.
So no,
it's
I'm not saying
Metroidvania
like,
burger.
Yeah, I'm not saying like, hey, this game is the definitive example of Metroidvania, but I'm saying that it taps into the same spirit, the idea of exploration and free roaming in a platforming space, but it does it in a different way, which is interesting to talk about.
Yeah, okay, I get it. I get what you're saying. I get it.
I think
you're unlocking new areas with abilities. And exploring a platforming space.
Yeah, I think you have a tendency to get hung up on semantics sometimes, which I don't know is necessarily...
Well, I am a writer.
Yeah, I am too, but sometimes you just have to say, it's okay.
Well, I think
so, in the spirit of the thing.
When we talk about Metroidvanias, we always focus on the action RPG. We always focus on like the platforming and the leveling. You jump and you make your dude stronger.
Yep.
But I feel like the puzzle solving element of a Metroidvania is important and often glossed over in discussions.
Yeah, I mean, figuring out like Myst could pass. Like,
yeah.
If the pop up didn't say Myst could pass, would you figure out that Myst could pass?
Probably
in Symphony
not.
Of the Night.
Yeah, well, one would hope, but who
there's
knows?
Also a block pushing puzzle in Symphony of the Night. You just push one box.
At the very least, you need to have the first element of every puzzle is the enticement. So you need to have that. You know, you need to have that one platform in the long library that you can't jump to, and you have to figure out, okay, well, is there a thing I need to do here, or is this a thing that I come back to later? Like, the entire structure of a Metroidvania is based on, more importantly than even the leveling up, I think, is the idea of backtracking. Like, figuring out that you have to go back. And that's based entirely around enticement and then finding the right key. So I think that puzzle element is part of it, even if, you know, a boy and his blob is, you know, no one would ever mistake it for a Metroidvania, but I see what Jeremy's getting at.
Yeah, like it's a side story. I mean, really, I don't know if I'd even consider Clash of Demonhead a true Metroidvania because of the way it's broken up and the fact that most of your gained abilities are actually purchased in a shop and are, you know, limited time uses. It's really more about like kind of exploring where the spirit of this idea of exploratory adventure action RPG games, like, where does that take us? Like, what kind of offshoots can you create from it?
Well, that's one of the reasons that when we talk about Castlevania 2, that I think Castlevania 2 is a failure. Because even if the leveling up mechanic and even if the, like, exploratory mechanic was good, you'd still have those puzzles that don't make sense. You'd still have those puzzles that are such a block to progressing that, you know, the graveyard duck.
Yeah.
Which was kind of like the precursor to Milkshake Duck.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
So, well, no, I think there is value in, like, saying, here's what a word means. But I think there's also value in saying, like, you know, let's look at the edge cases.
Obviously. And, or I wouldn't be doing this.
Would you?
No.
I thought you were just here for the gin.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm on to you. The gin and the cookies.
Gin and cookies. That's me. But I want to see a Boy in This Blob Castlevania mashup now. Can you imagine? Like, yeah, a Lucard with jelly beans? Yeah, Blob could pass, yeah.
What a horrible night to have a Blob.
Also.
Yeah, unfortunately, with the subsequent Boy in This Blob follow-ups, they've really kind of scaled back on the exploration and just made them more about strictly the puzzle. There's not really any freedom to roam around. And I love the Wii game that they came out with about 6 or 7 years ago. It was beautiful. And it had a dedicated hug button. Like, what the hell else do you need from a video game? But it definitely strayed away from the sort of Pitfall 2 feel of the original A Boy in His Blob.
Yeah, I got that. That's so weird how it did feel a little bit like Pitfall and stuff. It's just the David Crane thing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's just like this big space underground. Now, so it really feels like it was kind of cut from that.
Something
that
you don't know is I went as the Blob for Halloween 1 year. Oh, yeah? It took about 300 pounds
saying,
of...
Nothing can stop the Blob.
You just spoiled my joke.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Nothing can stop the Blob. No, I said it took 300 pounds of Elmer's glue. Oh, that was my joke. There you go.
Okay. I'm glad it was a different joke that I didn't spoil. Anyway, I think we've really run out of time here, so we need to go.
Yeah.
So this topic is far from exhausted. We'll probably do another one of these.
Oh, gosh.
And
we'll be doing these for years.
Probably. I mean, you can bail at any time if you
want. We'll eventually get to Guacamelee. Yeah.
Yes. By the time we get to it, it'll be retro.
Oh my gosh. Well.
So anyway, yeah. So Metroidvania evolved and expanded, yes, on NES. And that's awesome. And it's fun to talk about. You guys, if there's any of these games that you haven't played, you should definitely go check them out. Some of them are really good.
I want to play the Olympus game again.
Yeah, Battle of Olympus. Very, very good.
I've always wanted to complete that.
I have a really crappy port for Game Boy, but
yeah.
I don't have the original
game. I remember
game.
That, yeah.
I actually asked the creator of the game if he had been involved in the Game Boy port, and he was like, I didn't even know that existed.
Game Boy port?
It only came out in Europe, apparently. So he
then
was
he
like,
starts smashing things.
Yeah. He kicked me out of his office, threw me out the window.
I sure, I'll also play it.
Okay. Anyway, so thanks for everyone who was listening. Thank you for your patience bearing with us through this episode. That's pretty much it for this episode, though. So you are free. You may go. In case you're wondering, I'm still Jeremy Parrish, just like I was at the beginning of the episode. And you can find me at GameSpite on Twitter or at Retronauts.com. Retronauts itself is also at Retronauts.com, where we post cool articles and interviews and reviews and stuff. It's great. The podcast is on iTunes. It's on the Podcast One Network and the Podcast One app. That's great. We are supported through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. I think that's it. Ben.
And I am Benj Edwards, and I also need your help through Patreon, patreon.com/BenjEdwards, to help support my history and writing work. And you can also find me on Twitter.
Also, his 3 vintage computer a day habit.
Yeah. Gosh, I just burned through those quickly. There goes another Apple II.
You can find me, Chris Sims, on Twitter at the ISB, and go to the-isb.com for links to columns that I write around the web, podcasts that I do. I've got 2 Patreons.
Wow.
That you can find
Jeremy
there.
Has like 4.
Oh, so many.
I have 3. 2.
You can also just like send me money. That would also be great.
Okay. Here's some.
Oh, thanks, Finch. Out. You're a solid guy.
Paper sound effects.
And you can find me at your local comic book store writing Sword Quest for Dynamite, as well as Ash vs. Army of Darkness.
The 20.
And some recent Marvel comics as well, like Deadpool Bad Blood. I will also remind you that you can find exploration, backtracking, puzzle solving, permanent changes to the environment, and a persistent inventory across levels all in Super Mario World. One day.
Also one day in Heianko.
I thought we were going to make it out of here.
Heianko Alien.
No, sadly. Now who's the one who's obsessed with Heianko Alien, huh?
It's me.
Yep, it's you.
It's contagious.
Yeah. All right, so that's it for this episode of Retronauts. We'll be back next week with another episode. It might be on Heianko Alien. You never know. So please look forward to it. And now
hey,
we are
no,
going
no,
away.
No. Don't stop yet. Every episode is secretly about Heianko Alien. That's
I don't know what that is.
Okay.
Join us for the Heianko Alien episode.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.